Good morning. My name is Martha Wallace Masters, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. I don't like being here now. I've had a wonderful time up until now. I'm not a speaker. I talk a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, because that's what the big book tells me to do. But I always get very nervous and shaky and just pray that God takes over and puts the right words in my mouth. I do have a new husband, which I hope most of you have met this weekend. He's never seen me drunk. Now, my cousin Jane back there and her husband Leo, they've seen me drunk lots of times. And I'm delighted they came. I told Jane, I said, you know, I don't know if you're going to recognize my story because as you perceived it, you were sober. And as I perceived it most of the time, I was drunk. So we'll see. I'll ask her when this thing's over. I'm delighted that you invited me, that Milton invited me. Has Milton gotten here yet? You know, y'all should be a little bit suspicious when Milton invites all these people and then he doesn't come. I think I'd check into that. Something's wrong here. No, he told me that he wouldn't be here, and he said the closer the time got, that he regretted that he wouldn't be here, and I regret it too. I miss he and Joanne. I've known them for years. I can't remember where I first met them. Probably back early in my sobriety. Oh, I'm not from Texas. They say those people always give their sobriety date, but mine is March 14th, 1976. So, in case you can't add, that's 20 years, one day at a time. And it's been a great 20 years. As I said, Gordon's never seen me drunk, and so, you know, a lot of this doesn't pertain to him. In fact, I almost let Gordon get away. I want to tell y'all this little story. We'd been talking about getting married off and on, kind of, and I really wasn't that. I didn't want to get married really right then. It was kind of neat. He lived in the Kansas City area. It was an 8-hour drive over to Kennett, but he would come over about once a month. And that was neat. You know, I liked that. And this went on for several years. And one thing about Gordon, when he wants to tell me something, he never would tell me to my face. He'd either call me or write a letter. And I never did quite understand that. But after I'd seen him one time, I got this letter. And he said, you know, it's a long way over there, and if you aren't interested in making a commitment and getting married, maybe we just better break this thing off. And I thought, wow, this is bad. And then I read on, and he said, by the way, I've met this other lady. And she lives two houses down. So I got on the phone and called him, and he said, well, you know, if you just don't want to make a commitment. And I said, well, okay. Well, the more I thought about it, the worse it got. And I went to work, and I'd cry half the day, and everybody at at work was upset with because I was upset. And so finally, just out of the clear blue sky one night, I thought, I can put a stop to this. I'll just get on the phone and I'll call Gordon and tell him I want to get married. And so I did. I picked up the phone, I called him, and I said, Gordon, I've changed my mind. Will you marry me? And he said, it may be too late. I'll have to think about it. So, you know, I thought he'd just say, oh, wonderful, wonderful. But then that's when my AA program kicked in. I decided that I'd just turn it over to God, and that if it worked out, I was supposed to marry him, and if he didn't want to marry me now, that would be okay, too, and I could accept that. But fortunately, I was out in San Diego at the International Convention last year, and when I hadn't been there long, this bouquet of flowers arrived, and the note said, "Will you marry me?" And so we have proceeded from there, and it's been a great 6 months. I'll let y'all know at a later date how this proceeds. But most of my story involves my husband, who I was married to for 38 years. He died 5.5 years ago. And it's interesting, Gordon's wife died about 6 months before my husband did, and we didn't know each other at the time, but we have a lot in common. We've been through a lot of the same things. But as Bruce said, I'm really from Mississippi. I grew up in Mississippi. I claim Alabama because my cousin Jane and I are both only children, and she lived on the farm, and the day school was out, I'd go to North Alabama. Her father raised walking horses, and I loved horses, and I love them too, but I spent most of my time in the barn, so that's how my connection with Alabama is. And I stayed from the day school was out until the day school started, and then I'd go back to Columbus, Mississippi. But I had a normal childhood, if you consider the fact, no, it wasn't very normal. Back in those days, it wasn't fashionable for anyone to be divorced, and my father and mother were divorced when I was 6 years old. Daddy was an alcoholic. At the time, I didn't know it. But I felt different. You know, my parents, I was the only kid I knew that had divorced parents. And another thing that made me a little bit different was that my mother and father were older than anybody else. They had given up hope of having children. My mother was 42, and I think Daddy was about 45. And Mother discovered, the doctor told her that she had a tumor. So she had made arrangements to go to Memphis to have surgery and have this tumor removed. And one day she ran into her doctor on the street, and he said, "Matt, before you go to Memphis for that surgery, stop by the office one more time. Let me just check, see how you're doing." Well, when he checked this time, he discovered she was 5 months pregnant. So here's the tumor. But that's another thing that made me feel a little different, is the fact that my parents were older than other people's parents. I never knew my mother without Snow White hair. And my father's alcoholism progressed. He died when I was 14. And I think this is when my guilt started kicking in. Like most of us, then I've heard it said here, I never felt that I fit in. You know, I always felt different. I was very shy. You wouldn't know it now. I thought if I was real quiet, nobody would notice me, and then I wouldn't have to do anything. I always felt I was on the outside looking in, like I didn't really belong. But the guilt kicked in when Daddy died, because I was glad he died. I was embarrassed about him. I didn't know anything about alcoholism. But I knew something was wrong, and he had been a successful businessman in the wholesale grocery business. During the Depression, he lost everything. And I'm sure due to his alcoholism, he never made a comeback. He started being a traveling salesman. My mother was a very domineering type person. She always directed traffic. She did everything. We called her the general, and because she ran the show. And she had plenty of ideas on what I needed to do and what I didn't need to do. And actually, I never really made decisions. Mother told me what I liked and what I didn't like and what I ought to do and what I ought not to do. And I felt guilty if I didn't do it. But from the outside, I guess you would think I was a happy, normal person. I finished high school in Columbus. I went on to college at it's now MUW. It used to be MSCW, Mississippi University for Women. And I just didn't drink much. Occasionally I drank. Jane and I used to sneak in when our parents would have parties, and we'd steal the flask out of the men's pockets. You know, a lot of them carried flasks back in those days, and we'd nip on the whiskey a little bit. But drinking wasn't a problem. However, I learned quickly that pills helped. Now, alcohol's my drug of choice, but it involves some drugs too. And it started when I was very young. I was always real nervous. I shook all the time. I was very shaky. And if I got very upset, Mother had a pill called phenobarbital. This is before the days of tranquilizers. And she would give me a dose of phenobarbital. And it made me feel better. So I learned right away that worked. I don't remember when I had my first drink. I mean, it was just always there. Mother was not an alcoholic. And it was perfectly acceptable in our home to have a drink before dinner. That was okay. She always told me that it was okay to drink, but not to get drunk. Well, occasionally, I can remember in high school getting drunk occasionally, not too often. And in college, I would drink at home when I wouldn't drink on a date. That's something I didn't do. So it never was a real problem. When I was a junior in college, I met this nice-looking young man from Missouri, and I was pretty impressed with him. He had a red convertible, which was very impressive to me. And we went together for 4 years off and on, and eventually I married him. He went into the Air Force after he graduated from Mississippi State. By the way, Mother was... When I told her I was in love with this, or I liked this boy from Missouri, as far as we were concerned in Mississippi, Missouri must have been up on the Canadian border. and she said, well, that's fine, but don't you fall in love with that damn Yankee. Well, it turns out that his parents were born, and he was born in Mississippi, so that made him acceptable. And... So we eventually married, and he was in the Air Force. He'd gotten his commission. He was a brand-new second lieutenant, and we went to Wisconsin. We had a good time. We went to the officers' club. We partied. We danced. The plane, he was a radar observer. He flew in the back seat of a two-place jet, and they were grounded most of the time. So we just partied a lot. We had a real good time. No real problems with alcohol or drugs. I'm still occasionally taking... I guess phenobarb. I don't know what I took. I had some pills, I remember. Drinking, you know, it got to be a place where we were having a cocktail before dinner every night. Well, to me, this wasn't unusual. Mama did this at home. She always liked a martini or a Manhattan or something before dinner. And so everything went along well. Glenn got out of the Air Force. We moved back to Missouri. He was a farmer. That's what he majored in, was agriculture. And we lived on the farm. I had everything anybody could possibly want. I love horses. I had my own horse, my own horses. Barn right out the door. We had three children, all normal, happy. You know, why would a person like me that had everything they could want start drinking and taking more pills? After our first child was born, my mother was very ill. And... I had to go home. She had broken a hip. She had a stroke. And she was in one room, and I had this two-week-old baby in the other room, and they were both screaming and crying because Mother's hip hurt so bad. And I was just about to lose my mind, and this is where I was introduced to the tranquilizers. They had just come on the market, and my doctor said that they've got new pills out that are just wonderful. They aren't addictive, and you can just take them, and they won't hurt you. And so for years after that, as new tranquilizers came out on the market, I gradually took the new ones. Valium was the last one I had. I see a lot of clients now that take a lot of Zantac and stuff. I never got to try those because I got sober before they came out. You know, some of the drinks I never got to have either. I've never had a real pina colada, and I've never had a fuzzy navel. Thank goodness I didn't have to have them back. Well, that would have just added, because I drank anything. All the time my drinking is progressing. I'm still giving lectures to my husband and anybody who will listen. Anytime alcohol causes a problem in my home, we'll just quit drinking totally. I could preach sermons on this. And as it ends up, I'm the only one that's the alcoholic. But I just was determined it wasn't going to wreck my home as it had my mother and father's. So I don't know where I went over that line from being a social drinker. And I feel I was a social drinker. For when the children were little, I did everything I was supposed to do as a good wife and mother. I taught Sunday school. I went to church every Sunday. I had young people on Sunday night. I did everything I was supposed to do. Always having this feeling that I wasn't good enough and I wasn't adequate and I didn't fit in. My husband slowly began to complain about my drinking. And this didn't happen overnight. But I just couldn't see it. You know, what I was doing seemed perfectly normal to me. Jane was beginning to complain a little bit when I'd come to Alabama, because every time I came in Alabama, it was hard to get whiskey. You had to go to Huntsville to the liquor store, to the state store. So I'd just load up the trunk before I came down and make sure we had plenty of supply. But I drank most of it, I think. But all the time, I can't see this. I think I'm perfectly normal. Everything's going right. I didn't know, too, that when you took tranquilizers and drank, that it doubled the effect or tripled the effect of both of them. So I was doing this on a daily basis at the end there. I was drinking, taking pills, and it was getting worse and worse. During this time, some funny things happened that, fortunately, I can remember all of them. In the later stages, I had a lot of blackouts of things I don't remember. But one of them is one time we were down in New Orleans for the Sugar Bowl game, and we were all down in the French Quarter. I was all dressed up. I had on this black slinky cocktail dress. It had sequins down one arm, and this shoulder was bare, and I was really dressed up. Well, I saw this policeman on a horse, and I had the idea that this is what I really wanted to do was ride this horse in this tight black dress. So believe it or not, I talked him into letting me have his horse. And I got on side saddle, and I rode all over the French Quarter. It was real neat. They've got rubber shoes that don't make any noise, and you can just ride everywhere. And people were getting out of my way, and I was just along, and I don't know how I talked him into it, but I did. And then I got back, and all the crowd had gone into Pat O'Brien's. If any of y'all are familiar with Pat O'Brien's, it's a pretty big place in New Orleans. And I decided that the thing to do was to ride the horse into Pat O'Brien's. So I did. And my husband saw me back then, and Glenn jumped up, and he was running ahead of me saying, "Get out of the way, this fool's going to kill you." And people were scattering, but I rode all the way down through there, turned the horse around, rode back out. And, you know, I just did things like this occasionally. But I gave the policeman back his horse. In fact, I helped him load it in his trailer. It was time for him to go home then. But that was kind of neat. I might do that again if I had the opportunity. I wasn't always popular at home. My son had a motorcycle that I had really never ridden, and after a few drinks, I decided I could ride it, and I got on, and I took down three sections of our whiteboard fence and wrecked it. That wasn't much fun, but the sad thing was everybody rushed out and nobody asked me if I was hurt. They wanted to know if the motorcycle was hurt. Kind of hurt my feelings. One time I rode one of the children's bicycle into a ditch this deep full of water. And so one day I didn't drown. The only thing that wasn't covered with mud was my face. You know, things like this were always happening. During this time, No one liked me very well at our house, and my best friends were my horse and my dog. And I'd go out at night, and when everybody had been fussing at me and telling me how awful I was, and I'd get on the horse, I'd be too drunk to put the saddle on, so I'd climb up on the fence, bareback, I'd get the bridle on him. And I'd ride off into the night. The only problem was I was so drunk I'd fall off. And I'd be way away from home, 2 or 3 miles, and southeast Missouri is just flat as the palm of your hand. And I couldn't get back on the horse. Fortunately, he would stand there and wait for me, but I'd have to lead him home. I'd have to walk all the way home. That was pretty good. By the time I got back, I'd be pretty sober. And occasionally I felt, we had a cotton gin, I'd feel obligated to go up there and guard it at night. I'd get on my horse and strap my pistol on my hip and guard the gin. Nobody asked me to. I just thought it needed to be done. Sad it was so peaceful with Duke. He just was my best buddy. Another thing about Duke, that was my horse, he didn't like Glenn. And by this time, I didn't like Glenn very well either. But any time he would walk out into the lot, this horse would back his ears and show his teeth and just go for him like he was going to kill him. And he'd have to jump over the fence, and he invariably tore his slacks or his khakis or whatever he had on, and he'd be so mad, but I thought that was neat. And I could always count on my horse to defend me. But things kept getting worse. I was, by profession, I'm a medical technician. That's what I went to college for, and that's what I was trained to be. And I had worked when we were first married. I worked for a couple of years before we were married. But at the hospital down at Kennett, Missouri, I was living out in the country 20 miles north of that little place called Gideon. But anyway, the pathologist knew that I was a technician, and he called me one day and asked me if I would go to work. Well, in my mind, I thought, I didn't say this out loud to anybody, hey, this is just what I need, because I knew I was drinking too much. And I thought, well, if I go back to work, then I can't drink as much. I've got news for you. It didn't slow my drinking down at all. I worked for 5 years. How? I don't know. I was terribly shaky anyway. And even with all the tranquilizers and all the liquor, I was still shaky. And if you can imagine me going in the mornings to get blood, that's our job, you know, we're the vampires, we get the blood. I'd go in to stick people with this needle, and I'm shaking, so I'm just like this. And I've had people tell me later they were terrified, and they should have been. I'd tell them, don't worry, I'll just shake into it, and I was pretty good at veins, you know, even shaky. But fortunately, I don't think I killed anybody. I somehow managed to get by for 5 years, and then one day my boss called me in, the pathologist, and he said, Martha, I think you need to retire. And I said, what are you talking about, retire? And he said, I just think you need to retire. I think you've worked long enough. And I said, you're firing me. And he said, I didn't say that. And I said, well, I'm saying it, you're firing me. And I was so indignant, I couldn't figure out why he would want to get rid of me. Of course, the other technicians by this time weren't very happy with me either. I was supposed to be there at 6 in the morning to go to work. Invariably, I was a couple of hours late. And one particular old George used to say, Martha, you smell just like a distillery. Of course, he was mad I'd been late, and he had to do all my work till I got there. But anyway, I got fired. This gave me more time to drink. And by this time, well, while I was working my daily schedule, this is about how it ran. I got up at 4:30, I took a Valium. I did not drink at work, but I sure took the Valium. And at 9:30, I took another Valium. At 11, I was pretty down, so I'd take an amphetamine, a diet pill. And I was skinny then, real skinny. At 2, I'd take another Valium. I got off at 2:30, I'd start drinking. I'd go to the bar and drink till about 5, till it was time to go home, and then I'd drink more. Every night, I'd just pass out. I wouldn't remember going to bed. I At first, Glenn would try to get me up and get me back to the bed, and finally he got fed up with that, and he'd just leave me asleep, sometimes on the floor, sometimes on the sofa, wherever. It was bad at our house. During this time, he was drinking a lot, and you know, and I thought, well, I don't know why he's always fussing at me. He drinks a lot. But he wasn't an alcoholic. After I got sober, you know, it wasn't a real problem with him. He could take it or leave it alone. It didn't really matter. But the fight started, and he always started them, but I didn't give up easy. You know, he'd hit me, and I'd hit him back, and this went on, and the children would be there saying, Daddy, please don't hit Mama. And all the time, I'm trying to beat the devil out of him. And this is the way it was at our house. It wasn't fun at all. But I still couldn't see. You know, it was all his fault. If it weren't for my husband, if it weren't for the children and his in-laws, oh, Lord, I could not stand his parents. I liked his dad all right, but his mother was a witch. And didn't like his brothers. I had terrible resentments with all of them. And that's what I blame for my drinking. You know, it wasn't my fault. If these people would let me alone, I'd be okay. But it got worse and it got worse. And finally, Glenn and our doctor, the one who was giving me the pills, and the doctor would not have hurt me for anything. Back then, the doctors didn't know what tranquilizers and amphetamines did to you. My doctor really thought he was doing the right thing. And he was a personal friend. He knew I drank, but he didn't know the effects. And this is back in the early days. But anyway, Glenn and my doctor had a conference. I wasn't invited. And they decided that I had a terrible nervous condition and that I needed to be sent to a psychiatric institution, the Nut House, or as my sponsor who spoke here last fall calls it, the jitter joint. And so the next thing I know, they are taking me down to Little Rock. My doctor was from Arkansas. He knew a psychiatrist down there, and so they put me in the Nut House for a month. And the one thing they did for me, though, was to get me off the tranquilizers and the speed, the amphetamines. Now, I've plainly told the doctor that I realized that I was probably drinking too much, and now that he had told me I resented my mother and I resented all these people, that I wouldn't have to drink anymore. So I was going home and drink like a lady. And he said, I don't think you can do it, but okay. The first day I was there, he said, would you be interested in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I didn't know anybody in AA, and I didn't know anything about AA, but I knew that those were people who didn't drink. And I said, hell no, I'm not an alcoholic. What are you asking me that for? He never mentioned it again. I stayed there the whole month, and he never mentioned AA or my alcoholism again. And I'm not blaming him for that, because I lied. Of course, he asked me how much I drank, and I lied. I always said one or two a day or something. And but I got home. I didn't have my tranquilizers, and I stayed reasonably sober for about a month or 6 weeks. I'd have one drink every day. I was shaking so bad, because I know now that Valium and stuff like that, it takes a good while to get it out of your system, and my system missed it. And I was really clanky. Every night I would have one drink, and this was around Christmas. I went home a few days before Christmas. My children were home from school, and if you can imagine a suffering alcoholic who's got one drink about an ounce in a glass, because my husband dished it out to me. It didn't even help the clanks. And so this went on for a while. Finally, I just broke loose. I just got drunk. And by then, my husband's at his wit's end. He doesn't know what to do because I'm back. I can't get my pills anymore, but I'm really drinking round the clock. I get up in the morning. I try to be diplomatic, and I want them to think I'm drinking orange juice or cranberry juice, and I put about that much cranberry juice in, or orange juice, and about that much vodka in a glass, and that's my breakfast. Another thing I like to do in the morning, as I could get away with, was pour it in milk. I'd pour bourbon in milk, and that was that was good. I thought it was wonderful. But things kept getting worse. You know, I couldn't leave the house. I was a virtual prisoner because I was just too sick to leave. And Glenn's just out of his mind by now, and he remembered that one of our Air Force friends from Nashville had a father who was an alcoholic, and John's father had been somewhere, and he'd gotten sober. He'd since died, but he died sober. So John was a very close friend, and Glenn called him up and said, "Where did your daddy go?" And John says, Martha's really out of hand. John already knew I was out of hand. He was that close a friend that he knew. He said, "I've got just the place for her. We're going to send her to Minnesota, to Hazelden. That's where my father went." So the next thing I know, they've got me on an airplane heading for Minnesota with me bucking, kicking, crying. You can't imagine. I literally held on to the bed the morning it was time to go, and they had to pry my hands loose. I was determined not to go. I heard they were having a blizzard up there, and I kept thinking, "Oh, please, please, let there be a blizzard so we can't fly in." During this time, my spirituality had gone to nothing. I was raised in the church, but I was never comfortable in the church. No one had ever told me I could have a God of my understanding like y'all did. And as I've heard others say here, you know, I was scared to death of God. I knew I was supposed to do God's will, and I thought any time I'm in church, suddenly God's going to speak to me and tell me that I've got to go to Africa or to China and be a missionary, because Mama kind of led me to believe that's what she thought God wanted me to do. And I didn't want to go to Africa and China. But anyway, I didn't have any spiritual program at this point. I'd quit going to church totally. My husband would get up and take the children to Sunday school and church. He did everything. He shopped with them. They didn't want me coming to their ball games. They didn't want me doing anything with them. One of the worst things that happened to me, one time my oldest daughter was in school in Memphis, and she brought a friend home for the weekend. Well, the next week we were down in Memphis at school, and this girl walks in and says, "Good morning." And I said, "Hi." I said, "You must be one of Locke's friends. I don't believe I've met you." And she said, "Miss Wallace, I spent last weekend at your house." She'd been there the whole weekend. I didn't remember. This was 3 days later. So, you know, things like this were happening. But anyway, back to going to Minnesota. I didn't want to go. I just was panicky. My concept of people who didn't drink were that they were sat with their hands folded and they didn't have any fun. And there was nothing to do except be miserable. And as I said, I knew no one in AA. I had never I just never had heard of anybody in AA. And, of course, I didn't know up at Hazelden that that's all they talked about was AA. And I got ready to go with me. I'm in bad shape. I was so sick. I hadn't been to the beauty shop, and back then was when, you know, you wore your hair teased and everything. I looked pretty awful, so I had this old wig, and I put it on. But when my husband got me on the plane, he made our oldest daughter go with him because he said he just knew I'd get in the ladies' room and lock the door and he couldn't get me out, which I probably would have. But anyway, my oldest daughter was my escort. She never let me out of her sight. But when we got on the plane, Glenn felt pretty secure then, so he said to the stewardess, "Give her anything she wants to drink," because he knew he was getting rid of me. So I drank martinis all the way up on the plane. I was drunk. I was real drunk. And this wig, I can't quite remember, but all I do remember, I wish I had a picture, it had gotten turned around and the bangs were over here and I was peeping through this long part, you know, because I'd been screaming and crying and they were so embarrassed. It was awful on the plane. And it must have been a sight. Well, they got me out to the treatment center, and they left, and I thought, the jig's up. And, you know, what went through my mind is, I'm going to do what they say, and I'm going to get them off my back, and then I'll go back and I'll drink like a lady, and I won't do this anymore. I'll be good. Well, when I got up there, here were all these people. They were all alcoholics, and saying they were alcoholics, and I didn't want to say that. I hated that word. And the longer I stayed there, the more I hated it. Every other breath they said was alcoholism, alcoholic. And everybody there was one. Everybody that worked there was one. I think even the cooks and the yard men were alcoholics. And so after I'd been there about 3 days, I thought, if I hear this word one more time, I just can't stand it. So one morning, I just didn't get up. And my roommate said, Martha, you better get up. They're going to be mad if you don't show up for breakfast. And I said, I don't give a damn. I'm not getting out of this bed. I just can't listen to that word alcohol or alcoholism anymore. So she went on, and the next thing I know, I opened my eyes, and there are about 10 people surrounding my bed. It's the staff. And they say, what's wrong with you? And I said, I'm sick. And then I was sick. And they said, well, you better get up and go back up to detox, because if you're too sick to get up, we can't have you laying here in this bed. So I thought it over, and I said, I feel better, and I didn't try that anymore. Well, I'd never heard of the Big Book. I'd never heard of the 12 Steps. All this was foreign to me, totally foreign. And in my weakened condition after drinking so long, you know, my brain wouldn't really function, and it took a while for me to catch on. But after I'd been there for about 10 days, it dawned on me, these people who say they're alcoholics look happy. They're all just bubbly and sparkly, and they're having so much fun. And I thought, if you didn't drink, you know, that was my great fear. Life would be over. I'd be delegated just to be a bore the rest of the time. So I finally, after thinking about it, and they talked about a higher power, and I thought about that. And then it dawned on me, you know, I guess I am an alcoholic. So the next time we went around, they didn't make you say it, but I said, I'm an alcoholic. And it was like a great big weight had been lifted off my shoulders. I can't describe to you. I guess if I had a spiritual awakening, that was it. Because it was just like, whew, you know, now we can go on from here. I've done that. I've said I'm an alcoholic. But it took me about 3 or 4 more days to say I was a drug addict because I hadn't had any tranquilizers in a couple of months. And I thought, well, that doesn't count, and or amphetamines. But I guess I'm both. But alcohol was always my drug of choice. I only took the Valium because I could carry it in my pocket easier. You know, you can't carry a bottle as easy. But anyway, I stayed up there. I had a mean counselor. Her name was Samantha. We called her Sam. And every time I'd go by her office, she'd say, Martha, get in here. And she beat me down till I was about this tall. For instance, she'd say, how are you and your husband getting along? And I'd say, oh, Sam, he's crazy about me. He just loves me. He can hardly wait for me to get home. And she whoops out this letter and says, I've got a letter here that says he's going to divorce you. And I thought, oh, Lord, she knows. So I had to quit lying, and I had to get honest and really look at myself. Up there, as in a lot of treatment centers, they encouraged us to go through the 4th and 5th steps, which I did. And I'm delighted I did it then. I took my 5th step with a defrocked Catholic priest who was an alcoholic. And things that I told him I thought I'd never tell anybody. I first did what I felt was a thorough 4th step. I wrote down all these resentments and fears and everything else that goes with it. And that gave me a sense of freedom. I didn't realize that by not being a Catholic, I'd never heard about confession, but it did something. It gave me more freedom. By then, I wanted sobriety. I wanted sobriety more than anything in the world. And at that point, I believe I was willing to go to any lengths, as the book says. I think if they told me to jump off the roof, I'd have jumped. The men, they usually kept 4 weeks, and they told me I was a tough case, so they kept me for 6 weeks. And my counselor, Sam, wanted me really to stay for 6 months in what they call extended care. And I said, Sam, please don't keep me up here in Minnesota. I had a real communication problem up there with my southern accent. I couldn't understand those people, and they couldn't understand me. And I said, if you think it's really necessary that I go somewhere else, please find some place down south. And so she checked around. 20 years ago, there weren't many places down south. And one she finally found was Harbor House at Jackson, Mississippi. And so I spent one night at home, went to Jackson, stayed another month down there. So in all, I was gone 2.5 months. And I think this is what I needed. My husband came up to Minnesota. He went through the family plan up there. And he got furious. They told him he was just as sick as I was. And he said, hell no, she's the drunk, not me. And but later on, he figured out that he was just as sick as I was. And at first, when I got home, I started going to AA immediately. And in fact, a friend of mine from Jackson, being from Mississippi, I had some friends in Jackson, and he was married to one of my closest girlfriends. And Louise and Jeff had been nice to me while I was at Harbor House in Jackson. And Jeff said, when you leave here, I left on a Wednesday, he said, I'm going to call you on Sunday, and you better have been to a meeting. Well, I said, I don't even know if they've got meetings in Kennett. He said, well, I know they have them in Memphis, and if you have to go to Memphis, you just do that, and that's 120 miles. So I was happy to report when Jeff did call on Sunday that I had been to 2 meetings. Kennett did have AA meetings. I just didn't know it. I immediately became very interested in the group. I never missed a meeting. If we had company come in, I'd say, y'all just have to excuse me. I've got a meeting to go to. I was so scared that I was going to get drunk, and I really wanted to stay sober. And so I just went to every meeting I could. This old fellow, some of y'all may have known him down at Blyville, Arkansas, named Black Cat. He used to come up to the Kennett meetings, and he introduced me to conferences and conventions, and I started going to those. My husband was delighted. He didn't care where I went. He liked me sober. And that was another thing. I didn't know if he'd like me sober. They told me to be prepared for this, that you know, he was used to running everything and taking care of the children and everything, and he might not want me back doing stuff. But it worked out fine. He was glad to give me responsibility again. But he was willing for me to do anything and go anywhere as long as AA was involved. Now, he wouldn't go to Al-Anon meetings, or he wouldn't go to open meetings for about 2 years. And I kept, you know, I didn't even push him. I just invited him. But eventually, he did start going. And he became very active in Al-Anon. And he was the only man up there, and I think he thoroughly enjoyed that. He had all his girls. He'd say, I got my girls. And he was sponsoring them, and they were coming by the house telling him all the troubles. And you know, it worked out real well. But it certainly made it easy on me because I was allowed to go to meetings, and I didn't get any static on that point. I too, am a firm believer in the Big Book. I've studied it. I continue to study it. You know, I found out for me to stay sober and to keep my mind straight, it takes a lot of self-discipline. I get tired sometime of having morning meditation. I get tired of going to meetings sometime. You know, I think I'd like to stay home, or I'd like to go to the movie or do something, but I don't do that because they told me that I had to put sobriety above everything else, and I found this to be true. Over the years, I've watched other people, and the people that relapse and have slips are those that don't go to meetings and don't do all the things that I was told to do. And I I do them today mainly because I want to, but I still think self-discipline in this program is important. Because if I just don't want to go back to being that drunk and being so miserable and having all this stuff to worry about. You know, when you're a liar, like all of us have to be, you can't remember who you told what lie to, and it's awful. And I don't want to do that anymore. I still do everything y'all told me to do. And up until today, it's worked. I think sometimes we don't talk about the big book enough. Some of our meetings sometimes get kind of crazy, and they start talking about all this other stuff. But I prefer to go to meetings where the steps in the big book are talked about, because that's what got me sober, and that's what works. I'm still active in my church. I've gone back. I immediately went back to church. I know that's not necessary for everybody, but I know a strong spiritual program is necessary for me, that if I'm going to be happy and enjoy sobriety, I've got to stay in touch with God as I understand him. And I am a Christian, and this is what I believe. But all this takes self-discipline. Lots of times I don't want to do all this stuff, but then I think I'm sure don't want to go back, so I do it. I'm happy to report I'm still happy. When I first got back home, I was real happy. I was real bubbly, and we had this old fella, and he had one arm, and every meeting he'd look right at me, and he'd say, "People who are on pink clouds get drunk," and I'd want to crawl under the table. But, I like to think that maybe I have sort of been on a pink cloud all this time. I've had bad things happen, a lot of bad things. Eventually, I don't think it was Glenn's fault, but it was the circumstances. Land values dropped. We'd borrowed too much money. We lost the farm. We lost our home. We moved to Kennett and rented a house, and that's what I'm still doing. But, that wasn't necessary for me to drink, and I'm still happy. I think God has a plan for us, and we're just where we're supposed to be today. And I didn't know I was going to have to be here and talk to y'all, but if that's part of the plan, too. And if I continue to ask God every morning what he wants me to do for today, and if I do the footwork and to the best of my ability, then I think things are going to work out. So I'm still happy. I've got a new husband. We're doing fine. We have a lot of fun together. And I don't know how long he's going to put up with all my bullshit, but so far. So far, everything's going well. I certainly appreciate y'all having me. I've enjoyed being here. I've always wanted to come to Mount Eagle. I'd never been here before. And I've certainly enjoyed the fellowship. Y'all got a great bunch of people here, and I can see why you keep coming back. And I hope to see you again, too, before long. Thank you so much for inviting me.